I'd like to welcome everybody to Grand Rounds. I was in the back reading over Dr. Henry's CV and her accomplishments, and people in this room could accomplish 0.1% of what she's accomplished at a rather young age, it'd be amazing. Dr. Jamie Henry was the founding executive director of the Global Alliance for Surgical, Obstetric, Trauma, and Anesthesia Care, the so-called G4 Alliance. She holds an MD from the University of Santo Tomas in Manila, Philippines, and an MPH from Berkeley. She provided strategic direction to the G4 Alliance from its inception, developed and oversaw relations with stakeholders and partners, and organized political and advocacy events in support of surgical care at venues such as country offices, permanent missions, the UN, and the World Health Organization. She was the executive director of the International Collaboration for Essential Surgery, where she led the 15x5 campaign to raise the profile of essential surgery by 2015, hosted the first United Nations side event for essential surgery, and strongly advocated for the World Health Organization resolution on strengthening emergency and essential surgical care and anesthesia as a component of universal health coverage. She's the executive producer, director, and writer of global surgery advocacy film, The Right to Heal, which has been shown in over 60 countries worldwide and has been reviewed and featured at The Lancet. She was one of the Bellagio commissioners for the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery and participated in discussing strategies for improving access to surgery worldwide during the Bellagio Summit sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation. Prior to joining the Alliance, she's advocated for surgical care in international venues such as the United Kingdom Parliament, Johns Hopkins, UNIS Social Business Conference in Bangladesh, and the World Conference of Surgical Obstetric Trauma and Anesthesia. She currently is completing her second year general surgery residency at FAU and is alumni of the University of Chicago Department of Surgery. Please join me in welcoming such a esteemed speaker and colleague.
Thank you so much for that introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow residents, esteemed members of the college, my program director and the chair of the Department of Surgery, Dr. Thomas Genuit, good morning to you all, and thank you for the opportunity to present really what has been my life's work so far. First, nothing to disclose except my bias towards developing countries. Just a fair warning to you all. I'm going to show a brief outline of what I'm going to be talking about today. And I'm just going to take you through that. First, my story. So why am I here? I would say it started really from where I was born. I was born in the Philippines, and it's a developing country. It's a third world country. From when I opened my eyes, it's all been about disparity. There's always been this gap between the rich and the poor. And I grew up thinking about why this is so. Why are there shanty towns next to high-rise buildings? Why are there kids on the streets begging for money while I have my friends going to lavish parties right next to each other and people don't seem to care? And I didn't want to grow up in that kind of environment and just be callous and not and develop my filters where I couldn't start to care anymore. And so I chose medicine as a field because I wanted to be in a place where I could make an impact, where I could make a difference directly in someone's life. And in the Philippines, not more so than in medicine and surgery, that it struck me how, because you are born in this part of the country, then you want to have access to the most basic services that you need to stay alive, to have a normal, functioning, healthy existence in this world. And so because of that, I said, I can't stay in this country and I need to go. So I left the Philippines and came here. Found my way to UC Berkeley, MPH, went to the WHO, and realized that the disparity is so great, especially in surgical care. I remember an incident where I went to a remote mountainous region in the Philippines. That was when I first found my experience with surgery. We brought all our equipments, all the supplies. We bought IV fluids with us. We bought even the tiniest thing with us. And we went to an old school that was in the middle of nowhere and transformed it into an operating room. We scrubbed the floor, we cleaned it up, and we opened house. And when we opened their doors, hundreds of people came out of the woodwork, and they had these large goiters, these breast cancers, children with these large hernias. They've been living with this their whole lives, and they've never seen a doctor or a surgeon. And I stood there wondering, what's going on with the rest of the world? And why isn't anybody doing anything about this? And when I knocked on the doors of the WHO, it was shocking to see that there was nothing remotely specific for surgery that was there. And so I said, well, what can I do? I'm just this little person. But I have this passion. And I couldn't forget the image that I saw with all those people in that mountain area in the Philippines. I couldn't forget it. And so I spent 3 years in the academic world. I published some papers. I said, yes, I'm going to do something, finally. And nothing. And nothing. And nothing. And I got frustrated. And finally I said, you know what? I'm just going to pick up a camera and I'm going to let the patients themselves tell their stories. I'm going to let the providers who are struggling every day tell their stories. And so The Right to Heal was born. The Right to Heal is a film dedicated to these issues. We shot them in 7 countries, in Africa and in Southeast Asia. And when we did that, everything changed. It opened all those doors that was mentioned earlier. I'm not going to go through that. But for the first time, the conversation was open. Why are these people kept out of the conversation? Why aren't they part of any major global public health initiative? Until now, we're still trying to answer that question. But before we go through that, I'm going to go ahead and show you an excerpt of the film. It's a 10-minute version, so you'll see a glimpse of it.
The triumph of the last 30 years was the fight against infectious disease. Public health forces have all but eradicated polio and smallpox with vaccines. Death from AIDS, malaria, and TB are finally in decline, and the methods for dealing with them understood. But now, an epidemiological shift has taken place. For the first time in human history, the burden of disease requiring surgical care has overtaken that of infectious disease. Injuries, burns, obstructed labor, appendicitis, cataracts, hernia, clubfoot, cleft lip and palate. These are the public health challenges of the next 30 years. Their solution lay in distributing knowledge, not pills. The problems are vast. The solutions are simple. And millions will fall through the cracks until the public health sector recognizes the need for a paradigm shift.
Anak ko po si Rodney Malapas, 7 taon. Pagkatapos ng anak ako sa kanya, ang kanyang paa naman ang kapansanan niya.
Rodney, like 1 in every 1,000 children, was born with club foot. This condition is unknown in the developed world because it can easily be fixed at birth. Had anyone on the island been trained, some plaster and gauze could have been used to make a cast that would have corrected his feet. Now, he will likely be disabled for the rest of his life.
I was 15 years old girl, and I was in standard 7. And then I got pregnant. Those boys, you know, in the rural area, they decided to tell me those the way boys, they always talk, they decided to force me. After the forcing, you know, they were two, and then I did not realize what happened for me. They just finished. I went home and told my mother, and then my mother told me that you agree with them, so there's nothing like they forced me. You agree with them and you are ready to do those things, and you will find your home where you will be staying. It's not here. Labor pain started, and after there they take me to hospital. It take 4 days, almost 4 days.
Priscilla had obstructed labor, a condition common in very young mothers or mothers who are malnourished. By the time she received medical attention, the doctors were forced to cut her dead baby from her body.
After the operation, they took me to ward, and then I stayed there for 1 week, and then I saw the leakage of urine.
Fistula is a hole in the birth canal between the vagina and the bladder or the rectum. And this is caused by a neglected labor. For me, a fistula is a failure of the system. And a woman who has a fistula ends up leaking urine, feces, or both. And this is an extremely distressing condition. So we have in CCBRT a whole ward full of victims of neglected labor. The road to complete eradication of fistula is easy. You just need to make timely surgery available.
Injuries, obstructed labor, appendicitis, cataracts, hernia, club foot, cleft lip and palate. These 7 conditions make up the vast majority of surgically preventable deaths and disability in the developing world. They kill over 5.7 million people every year and have maimed hundreds of millions more. We are calling them the neglected surgical diseases. They're called neglected because until now, they have been ignored by the people setting the public health agenda. The poorest third of the world receive less than 4% of all the world's surgical procedures, even though more than 90% of deaths from childbirth and road traffic accidents can be found in those areas. The worst hit countries have almost no surgeons. Burundi has 10 million people, but only 15 surgeons in the whole country. Rwanda has less than 50 surgeons for a country of 11 million people. We consider surgery to be a luxury only for those who can afford to pay for it, hence its absence in any public health discussion. The reality is, these conditions are too expensive not to treat. Disability is devastating to the individual and very costly to society. It removes a person from useful economic activity and spirals her down into cycles of poverty. What we don't realize is that disability not only affects one person, but the whole family. It removes a second family member from the economy since they need to care for the disabled relative. Economists have estimated the lifetime economic cost of a disabled child to be between $40,000 and $200,000. The average cost to control a neglected surgical disease in the developing world is $400. It costs just $35 to cure a child of blindness, $200 to save a baby and a mother's life, $250 to save one child from a lifetime of crippling disability. A single procedure guarantees cure for the patient, since he will never catch the disease again. A single procedure can give a person their life back. All of these conditions are treatable through 15 basic surgical procedures. These 15 fixes, what we call essential surgeries, could take care of 80% of a community's basic surgical needs. They can be taught independently and effectively to medical officers and skilled health workers in 3 years, not the decade it takes to educate a surgeon.
People waste their whole life, which could have been done just by one little step. Some come with deformities, which are so simple to fix, so simple. It doesn't cost money, actually. In a civilized society, as we call it, civilized society, Nobody should carry the birth defects beyond a few days after the death, birth, and then it's a perfect person. It can go. No mother should die giving a child birth. It doesn't make sense.
It seems straightforward, yet we are so far from seeing a solution in sight. Pregnancy is an event that every mother should experience with anticipation of joy, not fear. But for all the deaths that occur during pregnancy, more than 99% are found in developing countries. Every year, about 250,000 women still die from childbirth, and about 50 to 100,000 women develop a fistula.
Surgery is not an option or a luxury. It's an essential life-saving procedure. So it can save the life of the mother. It'll definitely save the life of the baby. I feel very strongly that you can't have a maternal unit that doesn't have an ability to provide surgery, because if you accept that, then you're accepting that 20% of your women will potentially die, because 20% will go into a complication that needs a surgery.
Over 2 billion individuals are living on the fringes of public health, waiting for luck, for a passerby to give some money to give them back their lives, for a surgeon from some foreign country to visit for a week or two, or for a compassionate NGO to find them. The world seems to say that these people don't have the right to heal. The world seems to say that other people who are already there and willing to learn don't have the right to help.
2001, the world was standing up for infectious disease because it was killing our people too much. Now that we start to know what to do to control those conditions of infectious disease, I want the world to stand up for non-communicable disease. And among the non-communicable disease, surgery is important. Injuries are important. So go for it. Go to help countries to organize it in a systematic way, to bring services in an equitable way to each and every citizen of this earth.
We must show the world that no matter where you come from, if you're pregnant, you deserve the right to have your baby safely. That if you're born blind, you have the right to see. That if you're injured, you deserve the best chance to not be crippled for the rest of your life. That you have the right to heal. Together, we can welcome everyone into the new world that is 2015, a compassionate world that leaves no one behind. The triumph of the last.
Did you want to see it again? All right. I hope you enjoyed that. Okay, so that was a way to catch you up on what's been happening, or what we've been doing for the last couple of years in global surgery. My presentation right now really is about what's next, about what happened as a result of this film. Why did we get here, and where are we going? Where are we going next? And you know, I'm going to take you through some of my thoughts, some of my experiences on the field, off the field, reading, listening, and I hope that I'll take you with me on this journey. So the best report that really talks about what is the state of the world's health is called The Global Burden of Disease, published by The Lancet. And that's in a partnership with the University of Washington Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation. It's a collaboration, you know, amongst 486 scientists in 302 institutions in over 50 countries. And really, from this publication, it's a good news story, right? The good news is that, you know what, we've been successful. Mortality of children has declined significantly. We really, in a way, won sort of our early battles against infectious diseases, right? And now we have all of these other conditions that we are facing now because everyone's living longer. Now you have chronic diseases that are there, but people are living in a way, their quality of life has declined a little bit because you are living longer, and you kind of have to deal with that. And, you know, they've really charted out and tracked out, you know, the leading causes of death. And they've really, it's been a great global, worldwide effort. If I will take a piece of it, you know, because I'm biased towards surgery, right? Let's look at injuries, for example, okay? Now, road traffic injury deaths, you know, the burden of disease is 5 million. Sorry, for injury alone, it's 5 million, but for road traffic injury deaths, it's about 1.2 million. And 85% are found in developing countries. We talked about that in the film. But why, right? Why? If you look into the condition of health systems, of the health facilities in some of those countries, it's like this, really. So access to care has so many barriers. It's not just the facilities, it's the availability, the access, the affordability of surgery, it's the culture, it's the way people think about surgery. That's why it's not being accessed. And the model of surgical care for the last 150 years really has been what Paul Farmer calls parachute missions. Surgeons will come, and these amazing international groups have come. They built temporary infrastructure. They bring in their surgeons. They do the surgeries, and then they leave. But what have they left behind? So they did the surgeries, but they never really train. And I actually talked to one of the Red Cross heads, and he said, well, you know, if you actually train someone and you don't train them completely, you're actually doing more harm than good. So you are taking on that responsibility. If you want to do it, you have to do it 100%. And that's why it's hard. It really is hard. So it really is a tough undertaking. 2010, the Haiti earthquake. So that was a wake-up call for the surgical community. That was the earthquake, we all know that. It almost flattened a whole area in Haiti. 230,000 people died. What was the response? It was a major, like major parachute surgical mission. Everybody tried to fly in at the same time. Everybody tried to get in and try to help. But what happened was that there was in the air, they couldn't even land because they weren't ready for it. There was no infrastructure to getting people in. And so it was chaos. It was pure chaos. But what came out of this? There's one organization called Partners in Health who were spending their time building. They were just building. They were building a hospital right next to the capital city of Port-au-Prince. And for the next 2 weeks right after the earthquake, they were the most important center that actually took care of the patients who needed, you know, all the traumas, all the people who needed laparotomies. They were just running like in and out. They just responded quickly. They were there. And if we look at over 20 years of the human cost of disasters that the global burden of disease did not really touch on, we're talking about almost 7,000 natural disasters worldwide, about 1.35 million people died, 68,000 every year. And really, it's the disability that's that's affecting a lot more people. 218 million people per year are affected by these disasters. And that's not reflected in the burden of disease. That's not something that we actually talk about and think about on a daily basis. So when does it actually really affect us, right? So let's think about it. We you know, public health hasn't really focused on building health systems. And that's when infectious diseases start to cross over and cross national borders, when they're uncontrolled, when people don't trust the health system, when health workers aren't trained in infectious disease control management, when they don't have equipment, when they don't have supplies. That's when it starts to really affect us. And the Ebola epidemic was a great example of that, right? Sierra Leone, Guinea, Liberia, it almost decimated the countries, and they really was threatening national security. And you can see bodies lined up. And so what does this tell us when this happens, right? That, you know, we weren't really prepared when that happened, right? And our global health systems are not robust, really. And in a way, we failed. And maybe it's time to think, maybe we're wasting our whole energy repicking some of the low-hanging fruit that we've started out with. Maybe it's time to think more broadly. Time from vertical disease initiatives, maybe it's time to start, you know, on the hard parts, on the hard things, such as sustainability, health systems. And even looking at the way we've allotted our money, right? if you can see it, and this is up until 2016, from 1992 till 2016, it's still largely, so the green bars are HIV, AIDS, TB, malaria, maternal health, newborn and child health, and other infectious diseases. It's still largely, we're still largely kind of thinking in the same way that we've thought up, that we've thought through 20, 30 years ago. And the yellow bar is actually more starting, we're starting to think about health systems now. But I honestly think that we have to build more. You know, that yellow bar needs to expand more so we can start really kind of, you know, building more robust health systems. Okay, so now I'm going to shift a little bit, all right, and take a step back. You know, how do we get here? Okay, in the year 2000, the world said, let's come together and focus our energies. And they created the 8 Millennium Development Goals. And this is a huge successful effort. And if you look at these 8 goals, right, 3 of them are health related. Reduce child mortality, improve maternal health, combat HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other diseases. That's it, super focused. And the resources, political will, really was focused and it was successful. And now, you know, now we're in the Sustainable Development Goal era. That was 2015. And at that time, if you look at this, there's nothing for surgery. And we were so ambitious, we were like, how can we put surgery in there? Is there a way to do that? And somehow we did find a way. And if you condense the health MDGs into now the direct health SDGs, you have all these targets, right? It's still there, maternal mortality ratio, child health. But now we've expanded. We look at reducing premature mortality from non-communicable diseases. But the one that I wanted to bring your attention to is letter H, which says achieve universal health coverage. Well, what does that mean? Universal health coverage. It means universal. It's, you know, anything that you need, you will be able to get it. And we were so excited because then, you know, if you drill down to universal health coverage, it includes essential health services. And we were like, well, surgery is essential, right? Like, maybe we can just slot it in there. And so we started going to the UN and knocking on the doors and talking to people, trying to say, surgery is one more. Can you just put it in? Can you slip it in? And it was hard. We couldn't do it, honestly. They were like, what do you mean surgery? I don't really understand that. You mean surgery, like luxury surgery? That's not basic, you know? So we really, like, encountered a lot of resistance trying to get surgery right at in there for the world. So imagine in 2030, you wake up and there are still people who can't get basic surgery because they can't pay for it. I mean, shame on us, right? But now we were thinking, okay, universal health coverage, that's our in. Let's reframe it. Let's make an argument for surgery, right? Surgery exists within a system. So you cannot provide surgical care without a robust health system, right? Because surgery is service delivery, health work first. You have to have the information, infrastructure, equipment, financing, and leadership. And these are the WHO health system building blocks. So we made that argument with them, and they were like, yeah, it makes sense. And then we were like thinking, well, then surgery really is the perfect forcing function for health system strengthening, right? When you make a commitment to surgery, you cannot help but strengthen the system. You have to do it. You have to train that health worker to be safe. You have to train that health worker to know infection disease prevention and management. You have to build infrastructure. You have to, you know, invest in equipment. And so from there, we just started to come together. So in Amsterdam, we gathered a lot of people and basically said, now is the time, because 2015 is the time when they're going to decide what the next goals are for the next 15 years. And if we don't move now, we're going to be left alone. We're going to be left behind again. The boat is going to sail. And so people responded. So this Declaration on Essential Surgical Care basically says, we believe that as a surgical community, it's time that surgical care become part of public health. We believe that these 15 basic categories of surgical diseases need to be included. And we believe, so we just really came together and we actually got, you know, a pretty good number of people. You know, there were 55 signatories of major surgical obstetric trauma and anesthesia care organizations who signed on and really supported the resolution, the WHO resolution for surgery. And from there, we became more organized. Then we created this alliance, Global Alliance for Surgical Obstetric Trauma and Anesthesia. Right now, we have 86 major organizations who have come on and who've really come together in a very organized and systematic way to go to the WHO, because, you know, if there's one person like me knocking on the door, they're going to be like, who are you? But if there are like 86 organizations who say, wait, hold on, why can't you put into policy surgical systems to take care of the people, because that's what they need? And so that's when they started to listen. And we worked with important journals like The Lancet. We worked with the World Bank, who published the disease control priorities that has, for the first time, a volume on essential surgery. And that changed the tide. Finally, in 2015, that was the first time in the history of WHO that they ever passed anything that's anything related to surgery, anything. So that was like that was really a landmark resolution. So 192 member states signed on saying, yes, we're going to promise, we're going to strengthen emergency and essential surgical care as a component of universal health coverage. All right. I'm going to now shift again and give you a quick snapshot of what is the reality on the ground in some countries. This is a political commitment, but that doesn't mean that when you go to a developing country that suddenly it's going to be switched on, that there's going to be change. It's not the case. This is just a promise. Now it's time to really hold them accountable to that in very specific ways. So we partnered with the Malawi Minister of Health to work on their infrastructure. And we wanted to know, what is the capacity of Malawi to provide surgical care? We want to know, because there's no information at that time. And this is Malawi. Has 16 million people. It's amongst one of the poorest in the world. Infant mortality rates are at twice higher than the global average. In maternal mortality, they rank like, you know, the lowest, number 20, like lowest from the bottom in terms of maternal mortality. Physician density, it's 0.2 per 1,000 people compared with 2.3 for the world. And they have three levels of care, so and surgical training in Malawi is really pretty young. They only started the first surgical residency program in 2008. So really, it takes 5 years to train a surgeon, so really, there's not much. But Malawi has actually, back in the 1970s, recognizing that they've had this problem, started training non-physician clinicians. And so we wanted to find out, are they really doing anything? Are they making a difference? Who's doing surgery in Malawi? So we did the study. We wanted to describe the current health system and survey the elements of the health system, gain insight, and suggest points for improvement to the Minister of Health directly. So we did site visits. We looked at the surgical caseload, the surgical workforce rates. We did data analysis. We used an iPad, which helped. And we were able to go to 91.7% of the district hospitals and all of the central hospitals. And we found that who's doing surgery? Non-surgeons. 92% of people doing surgery are non-surgeons. And 70% are clinical officers who did 3 years of training, and the rest are medical MDs who have done surgery or who trained themselves or taught themselves, because, you know, if there's someone dying right there, you're not going to stand back and not do anything. You're going to do whatever you can. And for anesthesia, it's the same picture. And this only comprise 5% of the workforce in the whole country. And 95% are non-physician anesthetists. And if you break them down, the central hospitals, you can see this is 4.7 is the recommended in the world. And you can see that the consultant surgeon is in the central hospitals mainly. In the district hospitals, there's no surgeon. It's only the clinical officers that are in the district hospitals taking care of the people. And the same picture is in the anesthesia workforce density. And this is the surgical caseload per 100,000 people. In 2003, they actually started training more clinical officers. That's where you can see the caseload has gone up. So they're doing the surgeries. And if you look at the operating room per 100,000 people, you know, it's a sub-Saharan African average is 1 per 100,000 people compared with the global average of 6. And in high-income countries like the U.S., it's 19.5 per 100,000 people. And if you look at what are the essential surgical procedures that are happening? These are basic essential trauma care procedures. There's no laparoscopic surgery in Malawi. And if you look at the other procedures, It's happening. They're doing the surgeries. Also, in the district hospitals for, you know, C-sections, DNCs, hysterectomies, there are certain procedures that are not being done in the districts as well as they should. And these are the neglecteds, really. The women with fistulas who they're in hiding. They have no access to any kind of information, knowing that they can be fixed. The kids were born with clubfoot and cleft lip, the poorest of the poor. They're in hiding. And they can't get the surgery. They can't let alone travel to the central hospitals. And if you look at the infrastructure, you would see that in the district hospitals, those are the places where running water is not always there. Electricity is not always there. So sometimes they have to operate with a flashlight. Sometimes they have no functioning backup generator. In district hospitals, there's very little have an ICU in a post-operative area. So mostly the central hospitals have them, and also in equipment. So what did we learn? We learned that there are major deficiencies in basic infrastructure. I already went through that. And going to the bottom, bowel resection was only done in 17% of district hospitals. So, and looking deeper, actually, for the clinical officers who are trained in C-sections and laparotomies, they found out that they would do the C-sections, but they wouldn't do the laparotomies. And that's because they would learn how to open the belly, but they don't know what to do next. So there's major gaps in the quality of the training that they're getting in surgery. So from that, the message is, surgery is hard because it's complicated. It's part of a health system that you can't help but really invest in a major way. But when you do, it does happen and it saves lives. So what's the next step for surgery, really? Because right now, if you're going to ask me, you know, are we satisfied in saying we're really moving forward in providing surgical care to the poorest of the poor? Not really. It's not there yet. We don't have the funding. We don't have the infrastructure for global training. We don't have standardized metrics for tracking success. So now this is where the conversation is currently. The promise of procedure-based primary care, or primary care 2.0. Just a quick background. In 1978, the world again came together and said, we have a vision for the world, health for all by 2000. Okay, it's 2017 and we know they didn't really achieve it. But it established so many things, right? Primary health care, health as a fundamental human right, equity, appropriate technology, intersectoral development, and community participation. In developing countries, primary care is seen as a success. What came out of the Alma-Ata really is what they call the single disease initiatives, the verticals, right? HIV, TB, malaria. Those were the ones that really came out of it. And so they're saying largely it failed. But not really, because then it got the ball rolling, right? And The Lancet, in 2008, they did a 30-year anniversary issue. And they say, well, what is the relevance of this? And they said, honestly, it was largely successful, but we need to strengthen health systems. That was the message of the 30-year review. And they have specific recommendations. They said, let's strengthen health service infrastructure, like such as human resources and essential drugs, and I would say even essential procedures. Let's remove user fees for primary health care services to improve use, make it available to anybody, regardless of their ability to pay. Let's focus on the continuum of care for maternal, newborn, and child health services. That's needed, meaning from prenatal to actual pregnancy, delivery, and postnatal, so antenatal care. Let's come up with evidence-based integrated packages of community and primary curative and preventive care, which should be adapted to country contexts, assessed, and scaled up. And don't forget the community health workers. Don't forget the actual community. You have to get them involved. So this is what's currently, when they say universal health coverage, and when you say, well, how are you really achieving universal health coverage? They have 16 tracer indicators right now that they're tracking. And this is what they're going to be tracking in 2030. I wanted to just like go over them real quick. For reproductive, maternal, newborn, and child health. So they should have family plan. And this is the tracer indicator, the actual numbers that they're going to track, right? Family planning. Pregnancy and delivery care is really antenatal care, which is four or more visits. It doesn't talk about the actual, you know, did they get a C-section when they need it? You know, is it available? Child immunization, one-year-old children who have received three doses of a vaccine, diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. Child treatment, care-seeking behavior with pneumonia. Infectious diseases, the same, TB, HIV, malaria, water and sanitation. Non-communicable diseases, treatment of cardiovascular diseases, management of diabetes, cervical cancer, tobacco control. And there's the hospital access, which looks at the hospital beds, health worker density, essential medicines, and health security. There's nothing for surgery specifically yet. And to me, I think that that's where we should go in terms of advocating for a more expanded health service delivery. And we should make the argument that why don't we usher in a primary care 2.0 revolution where we can say, we are in this day and age where we can actually provide you with more. Instead of just family planning and antenatal care visits, why not provide emergency obstetric care to every woman? If you're bleeding out to death, you should be able to get into that OR and we should just easily ligate that bleeding vessel. Because there's a point wherein all the medicine in the world is not going to stop that bleeding. Why can't we provide that? If the baby's too big and it's obstructed, there's no way it's going to come out without a C-section safely. Why can't we provide that? For newborn and child health, I mean, obviously immunization and child meaning, absolutely. But what about the children with cleft lips, congenital cataracts, club foot? What's their future? Can we put them into the health system in a very organized and formal way? And for trauma care, there's nothing for trauma care that's tracked there as well. So as the population increases, what are we going to do with those who are disabled, with those who need basic trauma, basic life support? And this is what they've been tracking, what we already went through. And I would just challenge you to extrapolate that 15 years later, because this is what they're going to track for 15 years. Are we okay with just these? And are we comfortable saying, this is universal health coverage, guys? I'm not sure. So this is my last slide. I know it's been a long conversation. The future of global surgery really will start down once we figure out, you know, governing, financing, really the service delivery. When we train enough workforce, and we also include surgery in medicines and other health technologies to achieve true universal health coverage, that we leave no one behind. That has implications not just for health, but for the world. It has implications for poverty eradication, to end malnutrition, quality education for kids who are disabled. How can you go to school? It has implications for gender equality, for women who have not had act there outside of reproductive health services. Those with fistula, they're ostracized from community. It has implications for being an inclusive society. And obviously three we talked about. And lastly, inclusive economic growth and decent jobs. When we take care of our people, obviously they give back to the community. And we all rise together as one. So, now this is my last slide. I'm sorry. That's been the journey so far. Can we make sure that everybody has the right to heal? It's been a big adventure, and I think for me it's been phenomenal to see how the power of really. Of human story can move and change people in countries and communities. So I invite you all to join. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Absolutely. So the American Board of Surgery has actually approved surgical resident rotations in developing countries as long as they have oversight with the faculty. So there's a formal structure by which they can engage. The other place is Operation Giving Back with the American College of Surgeons, that they have formalized a way to find hospitals who need attendings, who need surgeons to come. But I would say that it's nearly not enough widespread and formalized and as ubiquitous as it is for internal medicine and pediatrics, that they have a lot of residents really go and spend time and help. So there's still a lot more to go. Oh.
Mm-hmm. Reference that a lot of the non-surgical ones are actually doing it. So who is in the forefront of those processes, really training their own in a shorter period of time, and maybe not completely duplicating our system, because for those essential problems, they might not need that level of training?
Right. So for East Central and Southern Africa, there's the College of Surgeons of East Central and Southern Africa, who's been at the forefront. They've built a College Without Walls. So they're in 10 countries in that region, and they will designate a training center, and they have a curriculum that it's a standardized curriculum for all 10 countries. For the clinical officers, the EU actually funded, they gave 7 million euros to do a randomized controlled trial to look at the outcomes from training clinical officers in Malawi. So the result of that is actually coming out soon, and it's been favorable. So because of that, then they've actually they've switched over to Surge Africa, where they're actually now really training them and deploying them. And in fact, they just sent 14 clinical officers to the district hospitals. And now the problem now is they want equipment. So where's the laparotomy set? So as you can see, there's a mismatch, right? They have the skills, they're so excited, but they can't do the surgery because they don't have the way to do it. Thank you.